right.
Today is Monday, March 6th, 2023. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. And Scott spells his name S-C-O-T-T, last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Scott. How are you today?
Yeah, it's all well. It's sunny in Santa Cruz, and it's really nice.
Good.
No rain, dead calm, gorgeous day here.
Nice. So glad to hear it. Yeah, weather's been quite something here this spring. Scott, at the end of the first interview, you left us off in either 1968 or 1969. You're standing with your good friend, Gary Dubois, and Gary is in a phone booth on a phone call to either Rob or Lou Elliott with American Raft Touring Association, ARTA. And can you pick that story up?
Sure. I will. And that's all correct. And it was in Angel's Camp is where we made that phone call to Oakland for ARTA. And doing so, Gary needed to find out what his schedule was and where he was going to work for the season. And with that phone call, he found out, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to Oregon, and then I'm going to go somewhere else or whatever. And then Gary says, oh, either Lou or Rob said, is Scott there? And we said, yeah, he's right here. And he says, ask him if he would like to go and work in Idaho and row for the company there on the Middle Fork. And I was shocked because I had rowed on the Stanislaus in the South Fork of American. And I went through one day or a couple of days at the max of training prior to this phone call for ARTA on the boatman training trips on the Stanislaus. And they figured that I was ready to go to Idaho and row for them. And I didn't feel totally competent, but I was willing to. I'd been through so much just in the training programs because it wasn't always the easiest water in situations we got into.
Well, tell me about that. What were those couple of days of training like? What'd you do?
Well, there was a fair number of guys. I don't remember any women there, but they did join later on. Those were people that were picked up from the Bay Area, the Sacramento area. And those folks, we all were pretty green. I had enough experience with Gary Dubois and Mark Dubois doing all that cave exploring stuff. So I'd been down a few times, and I'd rode, you know, a fair amount to know what I was kind of doing. They were teaching me how to read water. And so I learned a lot then. And then I went into the official kind of training that at that time, they were so desperate for boatmen that there was no charge. If you had talent and interest, show up, and you're going to go through training with the older guides. And this is all at the very, very new portion of river running and rafting. So they were desperate to get anybody that knew what was going on. So a few of those folks were from my particular area in Sacramento, Bay Area, some of these folks. But anyway, we all ended up being shot over to various places, up to the Grand, Oregon, or wherever. But for me, I ended up going to Idaho. And that
so
was...
Do you remember that training at all? I mean, I'm assuming throw bags were probably not invented yet by then.
Oh, no. No way.
And you know, wooden frames... I doubt there was any kind of swift water training. We're going to wrap you around a log so you can feel what that feels like, you know, in a strainer. I'm imagining it was just
like
get in and row and let's see how you do.
And yes, and there would have been, you know, we're in an old Army 10-man raft, and the oars were not the newest oars. They were oars, but they were old, and the equipment was old, and ammo cans and rocket boxes and all that stuff, everything was from the World War II, basically, or a Korean War. So it was kind of funky in all those respects, but doable. And when you don't know any better, you learn what should be better and what should be done later down the line.
Okay.
But at the time, no, it's all very crude. And the guys that knew what they were doing would, you know, say, okay, you know, you want to set up for a ferry left to go around this big rock boulder in the center of the river and watch out for this wall. So you want to defend against that wall. And that's just how we went. It was just like learn by putting you in the fire and gone
okay.
off you went.
And Suman life jackets were the Mae West big bulky things?
Oh, yeah. And not, well, I think as I recollect, there was quite a bit of water during the training trip. So I think we did have life jackets, but in this period, life jackets were almost, you know, it's up to you. It's, you know, I
okay.
think if there were life jackets around to give to the passengers, they would get them. But the boatmen, there's plenty of pictures and movies I've seen. We never had life jackets on. And
okay.
that would go somewhat in the Grand Canyon, too.
Yes.
Idaho as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
And they would have been Mae West, and a lot of them, they were what were called Kapok pockets that were from the war. And when we got them, they might have holes in them, so all they ended up doing is absorbing tons of water, and they become like, you would just die. If you went in the water, it would be like having 25 extra pounds putting you under the water.
Right. So this is a cloth covering of a plastic bag full of air and Kapok. And if that plastic bag got punctured, then water would get into the Kapok and make the whole thing very heavy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that was not uncommon to like have a stack of Kapok life jackets, and you'd be going, you'd squish them and you go, this one will work. Okay, that one, this one doesn't work. That one won't work. That one's
okay.
full of water. So that was common in the very beginning to sort it out. New life jacket styles hadn't existed. Black bags, waterproof bags didn't exist other than what the Army had, and we used the big black bags for food, gear, everything. But there was nothing. You couldn't, it was hard to find. You had to make your own frames, repair your own boats that were cracked and leaky and so forth. It was a very crude period to learn on, but that's when it started.
Okay, so you got invited to run the Middle Fork. So tell me about that. How'd you get up there? Who'd you meet? What do you remember about that first trip?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting period right then. And I lived in Sacramento, and the truck will show up to pick you up with all the gear and the guides at your home in Sacramento. And from there, you'll go to Boise. And then from there, you'll go to Salmon, Idaho. And that's where KOA camp is, where we are staging all of the river trips for the guides from. And that'll be a tent you can sleep in there. And there's a little tiny shed that had equipment in it. And so we went from Sacramento to Boise and then to Salmon in northern Idaho. And from that point on, it was, we've got a trip coming in a day or two or whatever. And we would load up the truck that I rode in from the West Coast with all the gear, all the guys. We would go and buy food and salmon. We'd load it all up into rocket boxes, probably, or I think we were in the process of making fiberglass boxes with styrofoam and hinging them, and that was where we would put our food in a relatively, they didn't have big coolers at that time, so we had to make them, and a lot of times it was terrible because everything was like in the last minute. Oh, we don't have this. Oh, this didn't get put on the truck. Oh, my God, we got to make coolers. And then the food would be fresh, but when we put in these coolers to keep them frozen for 7 days, the smell of fiberglass would permeate all the food.
Oh, wow.
And it was just drove me crazy. And it was like, how can we have, you know, we're on a river trip, you know, a couple days into it, we're pulling out steaks or we're pulling out chicken or we're pulling out pork chops or we're pulling out anything, and you're finding out that the fiberglass has set, and it's not gummy or anything, but the smell just was locked in these boxes.
Wow.
It was just terrible. But that was, you know, either nobody knew any better or nothing was sophisticated, and we were just, everything was flying by intuition, whatever. It was weird. But that's, looking back and explaining this to you, compared to what it turned into, I just go, I can't believe we sold this to people. It's terrible. Unbelievable.
The middle fork, there's a little dirt road that leads into kind of a parking area. This is what it's like today, and there's a big ramp that goes down to the river. What was it like the first time you went there?
Okay, you're exactly right. And you went through all these beautiful meadows, and sometimes we would start the trip so soon that there was snow through all that. We weren't sure we were able to get from Stanley, which is where we picked the people up who were in a hotel there. We would go across that meadow in the snow, and we would just do our best to make sure we could get to what you're talking about, that parking lot. And the ramp was there. And so when we got there, after picking the people up and we give an orientation, then we would take, we would get the boats. I don't think we would load the boats before we put them down the ramp. I think we would cart them or carry everything down to the river.
Okay.
And load the boats there. But we got there, and what little park service or authorities, very few people were of that nature in any of these Idaho rivers. This was again, a new thing, rafting. And so the rangers came up to it and said, the river is in flood right now, and there's been a flip and a death on the river, and it'll be, what we know of is it will be down at so-and-so. I had never been down the river, so I don't know if he said it's at so-and-so falls or Velvet Falls or here, but he said this is where you should pull over and see if you can find the gear that was put, I think they might have helicoptered the poor guy out. The boat was wrecked, and we did find the ammo cam, and he was from Stanford, California, Stanford University up in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And so we ended up going out for the very first trip in the Middle Fork in Idaho, was helping find this poor guy that drowned in flood water, taking his gear off all the way down till we ended up on the salmon, Maine salmon, where the trip basically ends. But that was my first time on a commercial trip, was being told that you're going to be, we're not closing the river down, of which later, I believe, in other years, they would have closed it. They wouldn't have sent boats down. It was huge. So here we are.
And this would have been, so I'm going to back up, this is the U.S. Forest Service that's operating that river that in that area. It's not national park. And
right.
So at that point, today, all the trips that launch on every given day get together with a Forest Service ranger, and they choose their camps. I'm assuming none of that happened back then.
Oh, God, no. There weren't enough people out there to fill up any camps that were down there.
Okay.
There was no problem, not like Grand Canyon is now, or any of these places now are just like, you've got to have, a ticket to get into this campsite. But no, back then it was, finding a camp, nobody knew what campsites were. So it was kind of like, keep your eyes open, and we got to get to camp pretty soon because you got to, this and that's going wrong. And I know there's one, my boat had ripped the floor out on some rocks at a lower water, or else just a tree. And then the only thing that was happening, the rangers knew nothing. They knew nothing. I'll just quickly say, on the Selway, which is a whole nother day and afternoon of telling you what happened on the Selway. But on the Middle Fork, what little conversation you had with anybody, the only thing I got was from people who'd been down in the flood, and they would tell you, okay, when you get to so-and-so turn, there's going to be a log jam, so make sure you stay on the right and on, And, you know, you're talking to a bunch of fresh guys. I don't know how many people. There might have been one or two guys that have been down before. But going down in flood with logs and log jams and the rapids being so different than just like a couple feet of water, 2 or 3 feet of water. This was almost 6 feet or more. So
6 feet on the gauge is some pretty hairball stuff going on in there, especially at the lower end.
Absolutely. There was like, you know, oh, and the other thing is that talking about how crude the equipment was and worn out it was, everybody had a spare oar on their raft slapped to the sides of it, tied in, and the oars were so rotten and bad, we were breaking the oars.
Oh, wow.
And so we were breaking oars, and there was a time that, you know, everybody's eyeballs are wide open because we are moving so fast, and we're dodging big boulders, and the runs aren't there anymore, and we're just hanging on for our own lives, really getting down through this thing. And the moment I'll never forget is keeping all the boats kind of together in, like, because it was horrific conditions. It'd be nice to know if somebody flipped or somebody wrapped on a log or somebody lost some people. But it was going too fast, and it was so disorganized. The river was just charging down through all this. And the oars were breaking, and we were using up our spare oars. And I remember John Seppi, who went to Grand Canyon eventually too, but he was there in Idaho.
How do you spell John's last name?
I think it's S-E-P-P-I.
Thank you.
Seppi.
Okay.
John Seppi.
So John's on that trip?
He's on the trip, and he's the biggest guy, the strongest guy that we have on the trip. And we all were pretty fit, but being thrown into these conditions tested your physicality and how much pulling you could handle, how much energy, you know. It was just like we were just spilling energy out into the river trying to keep boats, you know, together, getting them past rocks, jams, going, oh, God, I don't want to go over that falls there, and blah, blah. So it was exhausting. But John was a big guy, and he had some experience. So I remember somebody shouting out, I broke my oars, and we had run through the spares per boat, and John had a spare. And I remember him like a javelin getting it untied and heaving it across to another boat that was able to catch it and slap it on. And this is in the midst of all this chaos that we're in. And no boats, luckily, thank God. It was probably, I think it was raining too.
Oh,
here you're at, it was like, give me a break, man. And so it was cold, raining, and so out of control with all that water. And this is with people. This is with people that paid to go through this. And you're just going, man, I would never be here if I wasn't paid to do this. I know, you know, and I look at these people and I go, God, you paid for this? You could die. We could all die today. And so I just remember John taking that oar and slinging it through the air like a javelin, and somebody caught it in the midair, threw it under their thole pins, and continued on, you know. And that's how that first day went on the Middle Fork. And then
I just want to back up for a second and say, why were the oars in such bad shape?
Because it was the start of the season, and the warehouse was in Martinez, which I didn't know too much about Martinez, but that's where everything was hanging out. And whoever loaded up the truck there, it wasn't like you had a nice, you know, tidy shop where all the oars were taken care of and fiberglass if needed, the blades fiberglass or whatever. But these were old and rotten, and you know, they came from either Korean or World War II. And they were got, I don't know where Lou got them, but they were just terrible. So here we were starting out with boats that were rotten and poor, and then oars that were feeble. And whoever stages all that stuff in Martinez, It was at that time, it was more or less, here's the truck, it's in trailer, it's loaded up and head on out. You know,
okay.
You got everything there. So,
all right.
Yeah, it's so different now. I mean, we cut our teeth on fuck, you know, this is terrible, you know. What do we have to repair to get down? Did your frame break, you know,
so
all this stuff.
I'm also thinking at high water, it's kind of hard to find camp because the nice sandbars are underwater.
Oh, yeah.
So you're kind of pushed off into the veg. And then if it's raining,
yeah.
you know, the sort of tarpology comes out and everybody, you don't want to set up some tarps and then try to get your kitchen set up under the tarps. And eventually you're going to try to set up your own camp for the night. Is that
yeah.
kind of how that situation worked then?
Absolutely. I can remember the first night's camp, and I had ripped the floor out of my boat quite a ways. I had to sew up, you know, the boat's maybe 18 feet long or something
mm-hmm.
like that, old 10-man's, and I had slit the bottom of that thing. So getting to the first campsite, which we found after Velvet, and I think there was a name of a, I don't know if it was Pump House Wash or some, there was some name after Velvet. And it was, like you say, the water was so high that we would pull in, and it wasn't much farther from the river that it was all vegetation and trees and everything. It was kind of, we didn't cut anything down to make a camp, but it was kind of brutal with the rain and setting up campsite, getting dry wood. There was no Coleman stoves. It was all we needed, wood to have cooking fires. And so that wood had to be, I mean, here you're in the rain, you're in floods, everything is soaking wet. And God, I have, you know, thinking back on all these moments, like, and compared to, like, people having propane tanks and doing their cooking and all this crap.
Taco pads and camp chairs and, yeah.
Huh. All that. I, it's not that I laugh, but I just go, you guys have no idea. You guys are so green. You're so used to this easy stuff. I mean, we had everything was always in flood. Everything we ran in early seasons in June was always floods. And everything was keeping people dry and warm, would be maybe pulling over to the side of the river and getting a fire built and finding the wood that would be dry enough to start a fire. On and on with that kind of dilemmas, constant dilemmas of this. It was very raw, you know. It was just kind of like if Lewis and Clark were heading across and trying to cross rivers to get in place, we were just winging everything that we did to try and make people safe, dry. They would use tube tents issued to each passengers, which were worthless, and it was kind of like just throwing a tarp over you, and people would set up these tube tents. Do you know what a tube tent is?
Can you describe it for us, just so people
yeah.
who don't know can know?
Yeah, a tube tent was nothing but a cylinder of plastic, and you would run a line from tree to tree or a post to a post, and that would give you the ridge to hold the tent, you know, up. But the length of the tube tent was probably, 12 feet at most, and then you could string a line. And so basically you put stones in the corners, and that would kind of spread the tent apart. And the rains would just kind of come in the front or the backs of these things. So it was just a tube. And maybe some people would just forget any ties in the ceilings or anything. They would just crawl into these things and try and close the ends as much as they could. So they were just sleeping in a big tube of plastic and soaking wet. And so then you
right.
have to find days where it was sunny, even if that took a lunch stop to unbale everybody's gear out and dry it out. And that's what we'd have to do. And it was pretty ridiculous, but that's what would be sent out with all the people. And I think nowadays people would always, that's why the boats maybe have motor rigs to carry all the little tents that people probably get now and all these comfy things. So we had none of that, and we just made good. And making the fires was a big deal. Finding wood was a big deal.
Right.
That was, and the same thing in Grand Canyon. We all cooked there with wood. In the early days,
let's hold off for Grand Canyon because we're going to get
yeah,
there,
okay.
And I'm going to ask you a zillion questions about that. But
yeah,
but,
that's fine.
But finding wood on the salmon again when the water's low, you got a lot of driftwood, and be a little easier.
Yeah.
Of course, it's going to be wet if it's raining. So then you got
yeah.
that problem. You dig down big, deep enough in a pile, it kind of could dry out a little bit. But
true.
But that wood is wet when it gets parked there.
Absolutely.
And then it has to dry out. So you're kind of walking around through the forest looking for wood.
Exactly.
And of course, so is everybody else that's camped there before you.
Yeah, absolutely. And luckily, it wasn't that busy. Oddly enough, and I think it was a dory that had the death, and that thing was wrecked. But at that time, it was Prince Helfrich was from Oregon originally, and he was that company and the Helfrich family were a big start. They were fishermen, and so that was out of the Columbia and whatever. They would run these dory trips, or drift boats, really. They were drift boats.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were running on the Middle Fork. And so the only competition, really, and they had been there a long time, so they knew where everything kind of was. And they had the big boats, big inflatable boats that ran the oars off of the bow and the stern.
The scows, the sweep scows.
Yeah, the sweeps would be off the bow and the stern. And they ran that, which had all of the cargo, like you see on motor rigs.
Oh, okay.
Ran now and all that. So that would be loaded up.
So hang on, Scott. I'm going to ask you this about these sweep scows. The first time you saw a sweep scow, I'm assuming was in the late 60s or the early 70s. Was that already a neoprene type boat, a raft, a large raft type hull, or were they still running actual wooden frame type hulls?
No, as I recollect, they were big rafts. Where the heck they got the tubes? Maybe they were the same tubes we ended up in the Grand with, the bridge stuff. But yeah, it was, I don't remember it as wood. I remember it as rubber.
Okay.
And it was a flat platform. The guy would stand in the middle with no life jacket, cowboy hat on, cowboy boots, and he'd be working the bow sweep and the stern sweep, and they would go sideways. And it was like, talk about everything being an eye-opening experience for me in Idaho from California. And we weren't very well accepted as California guides there.
You were the outsiders, out-of-towners.
No help to us, which could get later in some of our discussion here.
Okay.
But we got no help from the Idaho folks. They had, and at the time, you didn't need an outfitter's card or whatever, a boatman card or a guide card, which all these guys were legitimate because that was kind of like a taxation for the river trip kind of stuff. I believe, you know, they, maybe it was so early in this idea of river running that they hadn't even set up guide cards or licenses to do all this stuff, but they didn't like us there at all just because we were outsiders, especially California. Man, we were not welcome. So anytime that they could screw us over or not help us on this and that, they didn't want to have anything to do with us.
Okay.
But so campsite wise, they were the only competition, and they knew what they were doing down there because they had run for a long time these fishing trips. They weren't down there to run rapids and have fun. This was fishing. And the dories, the drift boats, would all be the fishing boats, and the cargo ship would be the big sweep boats. So.
And their job was to find an eddy and stop, throw out an anchor, and just fish the eddy, and then head on down to camp, where the sweep scow would have gone down and set up.
Exactly. They would pass the drift boats, and the drift boats were all about fishing, getting into eddies and pulling in behind rocks. And it was pretty cool. They really knew what they were doing, and they brought all that talent from Oregon out. And the idea, those rapids were nothing but an obstacle. It's like, how do we get through these things? And they were good. The drift boats were easy to row. They weren't heavy. The scows were carrying everything. So those guys were, man, if you wrap that thing on a rock or a log jam, you lost everything.
Right.
But I never saw one. Nobody ever screwed up. And, but anyway, yeah, that was that.
And then, so that first trip, you remember John throwing that oar, hard time finding firewood. The tube tents were a joke. Yep. And they still are today, but in a pinch, they can help some. Unless you set them up wrong, and then they are good little culverts to transfer water from point A to point B right through your sleeping bag.
Absolutely. The little rivers.
Yeah. Little culverts. And there were some fun rapids in there, especially, what is it? Turnback Canyon? No, that's not it. That's on a different river. That last section, when you go down to the main salmon, it's a kind of wonderful, lots of rapids, just go kind of deal. And then there's final long straightaway where things are kind of quieting it down a little bit, and you reach the main salmon.
That's right. That is a good picture of it all. That was a very, I don't remember the names of a lot of this. Otter Bar was, they got to wrap it up farther. There's a lot of names of that stuff I don't recollect. But it was really, once you're on just like a 2 to 3 foot river, those rapids are real technical and they're really fun. And we had no, problem. The guys, as you went trip after trip for the season, you might do 7 or 8 trips, 7-day trips. And, all of us that started out in flood as novices, we were pretty seasoned by the next trip and the next trip and going, wow, what's deadhead mean? The water's so low that you got to bring everything down with no passengers, and we'll fly all the gear into Indian Ranch and Indian Creek Ranch, or the airport. It's an airport. It's just a landing strip there at Indian Creek.
Right.
But all the gear would be flown in there, and you bring the boats down from the put-in to Indian Creek. And, gosh, I think all the people must have been flown in, too.
Yep.
All the people flown in. We started out a day and a half before we picked them up, and we would walk through rapids, which gets into my Grand Canyon low water story. But yeah, we would row as best we could down through there, and it was in a much nicer period of time in the year because it was sunny, warm, and it wasn't snow and rain and cloudbursts and just all the side canyon creeks throwing water in. And oh man, all that was like just really, it's like going to war. If you'd never been in war, it was like, how do we survive this? And every early season trip was like full of log jams and all sorts of, and the weather was terrible usually. And it was a really blessing if you got a sunny day when it was questionable conditions down there, and you go,
right,
wow, at least won't be frozen.
Right.
So
yeah.
That was that.
Okay.
Oh, and then what you're talking about is, when you hit the main and then you go a little bit farther down for your takeout, that was really fun because you like came out of, it was like you were in a roller coaster ride at a carnival or something like that. You finally break through all the rapids and all this stuff, what's it called? I can't think of what the Bighorn or the Desolation. I don't know. Can't think of what the name of all that area is. As you finally go out of Middle Fork, you leave that canyon area, and when you hit and you go out, it's kind of like the doors were open, and you're out in the big main salmon that was never really flooded. I don't remember it ever flooding so much or it being a problem, but it was kind of like, wow, this is we're opening the doors, and now we're going out on the main, and we'll be at our takeout site just in a few minutes and say goodbye to the Middle Fork.
Yeah.
And then now it's really kind of a very powerful ending after you've been through all this stuff and you go, wow, we went through, it's like the Wizard of Oz coming through something. It's pretty cool.
So seven or eight trips a season, that first season, is that roughly how many trips you ran?
Yeah, and they were 7-day trips, so it was kind of like you ran, went back on that dirt road back to Salmon, and loaded up, got gear, got food, did all that, went to the bars, partied, danced, and go back to KOA camp where our tent would be, and see what chores we had to do to fix this and that and all that.
Fix the holes in the boats and try to find better oars.
Yeah. and make phone calls to Oakland and say, hey, man, this isn't cutting it. We broke all the oars. We don't have oars. On and on and on. And we would try and have it. And they would complain and say, we haven't got our checks either. When are we going to get our paychecks?
Oh, no.
They're coming. They're coming. We're late on accounting right now. On and on and on. So it's just kind of like, we were kind of like just left out. It just seemed like we were just abandoned and we had all this responsibility.
What was your pay? And, what was your pay back then?
Gosh, it wasn't that much. I think in a season, all summer, I would net maybe a couple hundred bucks. And I could get unemployment insurance back then when I would go back to Sacramento. So that helped a little bit, but it wasn't much. It wasn't like an hourly pay. I think it was just like per trip, you'd get 60 bucks or something like that. It wasn't much, very little. And a surprise, I went to Europe after an Idaho season, and I'd been saving my money for every season I had done. And I had saved enough that I could go to Europe for the winter and travel. And it was from specifically the Idaho pay, and which wasn't much, but it didn't take much to do anything back then. But they sure didn't want to pay us a lot of money. And I don't know what it's like now, but that was always an issue I and all the guides had, is that, you guys, let's figure out, you know, what you're charging for these people, which is now in the $5,000 plus for a trip. And I go, you know, we're getting this much, and you're getting so much, and we're getting so little.
It's pretty easy to work out the math when you know that, you know, each passenger is paying $100, and there's 10 passengers,
exactly.
And you're making $60 for the trip, and there's four of you. So where's the rest of the money going? You kind of work out the math and scratch your head.
It's very easy to figure that, which we all did, is going, Christ, man, you guys are killing it, you know? And you're asking us to take what I would consider an absolutely illegal load of people down on a boat that should only have, like, three. You're sticking six people and me and all of the food and all the commissary. And
holy cow, that's a heavy boat.
And it was super heavy, six people. And yourself and all the gear, not a backup motor rig that carried your stuff.
Yeah.
It was like...
or a sweep scow, not a backup sweep scow even.
Nothing. You had nothing.
Hmm.
So it was, as you found out, you get off the river and the equipment was bad and we weren't prepared for what we were going through equipment-wise and gear-wise, first aid kit-wise. The boats leaked, the valves were bad, you know, we're repairing things as we go. So then you look at what they're making, because we're rowing so many people at that price. I go, oh my God, we're all loaded to the max. The boats are practically under the water, and we're going through flood stages and log jams with these poor people, and we've got to come out the end, all of them alive and all of them in the boats. It wasn't like anybody quit because of that, but we would bring that up, and it was never probably a happy topic on the office, but I mean, we needed stuff, and every guide that was with us, we all knew it. We need these things, and we can't go out and do this. And that later on is the story on the Selway, and all that we, and I'm telling you now, came to fruition out on the Selway in flood. So
should we pick that story up now?
Sure, if you want. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my Middle Fork flood adventure, and that was, as you had asked, what my first trip was like, and that's what my first trip was like, and I learned a lot, and it was a good test of the metal of what you're made of, and what everybody, how we all needed each other to get down and figure things out. So then the next year we show up and we go out, and there's a little more organization now at the Middle Fork put in with rangers and so forth. We've closed the Middle Fork down because it's flooding, and we go, oh, that's great. So, and I'm not sure, but I'm going to skip. I think we might have, because of that, we may have been sent to Oregon, take all the people, ship them all over, and then we went to the Rogue and ran,
okay.
Which is crazy. Here we're on Idaho, and we go, everybody in the gear goes over to Oregon, and it was kind of fun to run the Rogue. I'd never been there and so forth. But then when we came back, there was a trip set up for the Middle Fork, but I think it was still unrunnable, and the office said, well, they haven't shut down the Selway because it was so, not crude, but it was like so undeveloped, like boating on the Selway wasn't done by many, if any. And it was, they said, okay.
But wait. If the Middle Fork is closed because it's too high,
right?
The Selway at high water is equally or more so terrifying. Did nobody connect the dots there?
They said that, okay, the people are on their way. The bus is going to pick them up, and we're going to run this Middle Fork trip over on the Selway. And they could have cared less, I think, whether it was in flood. We didn't know. We didn't know anything. It's okay. Just like, oh, the people are going to show up in the bus, and we got to get all our gear in the truck and our food and everything, and we got to go all the way, I don't know, through Montana or wherever. It's hours to get there. And so off we went to the Selway with all this funky equipment that had, you know, broken apart on the Middle Forks. And we show up, and we know nothing about the Selway, zero about the Selway. And somehow we got Brent Jones, or what was the, you might remember, the Jones maps that were of rivers that had been done, that he had mapped ages ago. And now that was the only thing we had, was this, the guy's first name.
Was that the Les Jones scroll map?
Yeah, the Les Jones scroll maps. There happened to have been one for the Selway. And I don't know if the guy really, Les Jones was, I think, a really great character. And he did the maps for a number of different rivers. And so all we had, and I don't know exactly how we got it, if it was from the ranger station at the put-in on the Selway.
Huh.
I don't know if it was there or how we got it. I mean, there's no way that, you know, this was like a spur of the moment. Load up, go to the Selway. People are going to show up tomorrow. But anyway, that's all we had, was Les Jones's map that was as good as anybody had. And so we got our boats, rigged them up, and the river is roaring, and we found out later that it was at 7 feet for the Selway. And that level held the maximum flood for a number of years as we got more modern with computers.
Wow.
I could look up things like that. And it held the record for flood height for many years, and it's only barely... what follows this story of the initial Selway is that I was asked when I was in Europe to come home for the season and do a couple of Middle Forks, and then we are actually going to sell a Selway trip. And do you want to lead that Selway trip? And at the end of the first Selway trip in flood, we all swore that we would never ever go down the Selway again in flood.
Yeah.
It was something. So the second trip that I led, it was even higher than that 7 feet.
Holy cow.
And Moose Creek was, we were starting these trips with snow on the ground, ice cold ice water. If you swam, you're dead. There's no wetsuits, none of this stuff. And so the first trip, we headed down and just used our map, and again, here I am. Everybody is going like wide-eyed. What the hell? We're roaring down this river, and the side canyon, side creeks are all pouring water in, and it's cold as could be. Luckily, I don't recollect that it was raining. I remember washing my face or my hair and moving snow out of the way to get down to the creek. And so it was very, very cold. The water was very fast, and the water was super, super cold. And I don't think it rained on that very first trip very much. I think at our Moose Creek camp, before we hit into the ladle and all that stuff, I think it might have rained there, but it was sunny for the big run through everything below Moose Creek, which was a blessing. And actually, I think we couldn't stop the boats. Now I'm kind of jumping forward, but we went down and camped below Moose Creek, and there is a ranger station above Moose Creek Bridge. If you remember or know of anything of the Selway, Moose Creek, and there is a ranger station there. And we camped. We were able to get a boat or two to shore, not knowing where any campsites were, absolutely zero knowledge. And we go, okay, the map shows we went under Moose Creek Bridge, there's a ranger station, and okay, so we're going to get a lot of water from Moose Creek now. The river's going to get higher. We got to camp. We got to stop before we get into this lower stuff with Ladle and everything, Little Niagara. And so we went down past the ranger station, past Moose Creek, and we just literally slammed our boats into shore to stop them and hop out and lash them to a log or a tree, whatever. And some boats couldn't make it, so we had to go downstream and pull them back up.
Right.
And that would have been, I don't know what night's camp it might have been. We might have gone that far in the flood.
First day?
We're going through. Go ahead.
No, first day?
Yeah, everything, of course, just like the Middle Fork or the Grand, man, you're going really fast. You're doing like 20 miles, 15 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So you're covering distance quickly.
Right.
I think it was max 50 miles was the Selway. I think it was a 50-mile run. But at that kind of speed, and I mean, we were just screaming down. So it might have been our first night's camp because we hadn't gone through the ladle stuff yet. And I don't recollect an upstream camp where we could pull over. But it was a struggle getting into that Moose Creek camp, which was right by the trail that is kind of a cool trail. It follows the river all the way to Selway Falls at the very bottom. And that was kind of a help. Getting people around rapids was, there was still a trail. There was a trail there. So we camped right below Moose Creek on that trail, and people were head to toe in their sleeping bags on a trail. And the boats, we finally got them all together. And I think it actually was good weather there at that time. And I remember people wanted to know what rattlesnake meat tasted like. And a friend and I said, oh, I think we could probably find a rattlesnake here. So tonight at dinner, we will have caught a rattlesnake, and we'll gut it and skin it, and we'll have it. And sure enough, my friend and I headed out. Do you want to hear this story?
Yeah.
Before we move on? Okay, so Matt Conover and I said, oh, let's go find a rattlesnake. And so I think just like the Middle Fork, but those mountain rivers have got lots of snakes. They've got lots of rattlesnakes and elk and cool birds and on and on and on. But the rattlesnakes seem to be pretty common. It didn't seem like a hard thing to do just to go above camp and go poke around rocks and stuff. And sure enough, we looked under a ledge, some boulders, that it was a little cave, and we go, ah, this is where a rattlesnake would go. If we were a rattlesnake, this is where we'd be. And so we went and got on our stomachs and looked into the hole in this cave of rock, and we go, and it might have even started to rattle then, but we looked in there, and we go, ah, there's one coiled up in the very back. And, okay, let's go get a stick, and we'll pin it, and then we'll kill it somehow, stone it or whatever we were thinking of doing. At that time, probably throwing rocks on it was the way that you killed a snake of that nature. But anyway, so we saw the snake in there, and it was buzzing. So we went and found a couple of sticks, and we go, okay, and we're laying on our stomach looking deep into this cave, and my friend Matt said, okay, I got his head. I got his head pinned. Okay, hold on to that head, and I'll put my stick on his body. And so we'll have him controlled. Okay, and he's pissed off. The snake is pissed off and rattling. And so we've got a stick on the body and a stick on the head, and then either Matt's stick or my stick broke, and it released the rattlesnake, and we're on our stomach with our heads in this cave, and the snake is so pissed off that he blasts out, and he splits the two of us. He goes right between Matt and I, rattling and wiggling as fast as it could go, because we had these two sticks jabbing at him, and we bugged him, and he was pissed. And it amazing. And on our stomachs, I mean, talk about getting your eyes absolutely as wide as you could with a snake coming right at your heads. And then he goes between our shoulders and down the mountainside. And I think we ran after it and were able to do something. And that was the snake that we brought back for dinner that night. And we skinned it. And some people wanted the skin for belts. And that was cool. I mean, that got used. And then the meat of the thing was carved up into little pieces, and we fried it with bacon grease, and it was really good. So the people got, we got a story out of it. We got scared to death, and it was just another, like, Jesus Christ, this river running. Nobody's going to be experiencing what we're experiencing here. And this is after the flooding Middle Fork. Now we're on flooding sellways, breaking oars, fighting with rattlesnakes, and we've got the biggest of the rapids to go yet. And anyway, that was...
using a Les Jones scroll map. All right.
Yep.
Very good.
It got us to there.
Yeah, yeah. And did it get you down through?
Yeah. So then we came and, oh, one thing we were smart enough to do, and this just comes with, you know, river running and having your eyes and ears open for everything, learning every foot you went, every stream you went by, everything you did, you're learning and learning and learning and learning, staying alive, getting the boats and the people down, is that let's do a layover. We have been through so much to get to this point. We should have a layover because we're about to go on this Les Jones map. We are about to hit Little Niagara, Double Drop, S-Turn, Ladle. This is what we have to be 100% on. So let's spend the day, the following day after we camp that night. Let's throw another day at scouting out what's below us instead of running everything blind. We've been through so much that and this is an idea. It's like in my history now with the Grand and the mountain rivers, is that we went through Ham Rapid, which in flood, in retrospect, as I was on the Grand Canyon, I go, you know, Ham Rapid in flood is just like going through Hermit. Instead of going through your little riffly mountain, you know, creeks, dodging boulders, this and that, you know, some fast currents, but Ham, a mountain stream, it was so high of water that it turned into Hermit Rapid. And I'd never been through a rapid at that point in my life. I've been through the rocky stuff and the hydraulics and all this, but to go just down a huge wall, come up the other side, standing on the tail of the boat and having it slapped down, it was like, wow, man, if things were like this all the time, it would be really fun instead of dodging rocks and going through riffly kind of things. I'll take these Hermit things because it's just a gas. And so that gave me some perspective in looking back when I was on the ground and go, oh, man, the Ham was just like this stuff. And then, so with that experience, and nobody had ever seen any kind of a rapid like Ham put up in front of us. So that's when... We figured after everything that we had rode through and the amount of volumes, if we have an opportunity to look at the worst part of the river, we should spend the day and the night, go down and walk as far as we want, which we walked a long ways, checking everything out, figuring out where runs should be, where to go in case somebody flips, where are any eddies. And we spent that day, luckily, from experience, to be going, we got to be careful. You know, if we want to get this trip down, we got to know what's in front of us. We can row this stuff, but we don't want to be surprised. So we spent, it was a great, great experience to everybody walk the trail for, you know, a few miles probably, and picked off what our routes through the rapids would be, where eddies were in case we needed to get out of the current or pick a boat up or pick a person up. And so we kind of mapped all that stuff. And so we headed out, and this gets back to all the rotten equipment that we've experienced on the middle fork. It was no better on the Selway. And we had stern lines that were out of hemp that were rotten and had never gone through the pull from a flooding river on a raft that was loaded up, tied to a tree in current. Those ropes were made for like duckies, you know, in a pool or something like that. And so what happened is that you know, I don't think we walked people on Ladle. We may have walked people. No, we didn't walk them. The next season we walked them on Ladle. We went through Ladle, and Ladle, we had never seen so many waterfalls that we had to kind of go through with the waters all sucking back upstream, and boats were going over these falls and getting sucked back in and spit out and sucked back in. And I came up on my friend Matt, who was stuck in one of these things, and the power of the river was so strong, it was bucking the boats all over the place. And when I came in, and once you set a line on the current, it was like you were there. It was like, I'm on the fastest roller coaster possible. I'm just roaring down. There's no getting left or right. You just got to hit everything as straight as you can and have everybody hang on. Don't lose anybody. And so my friend Matt was stuck on one of these reversals in the middle of Ladle, and I'm coming down at full velocity. I go down and hit him, and that was a good thing for him because it pushed him out, and he was able to get out of that reversal. Not quite unlike Lava Falls, when not quite as big, but big and ugly as the reversals behind Lava Falls at good-sized water.
At the ledge hole, sure.
What's that?
At the ledge hole, yeah.
Yeah. So it was a good thing. I came down and I hit Matt and I knocked him out of that reversal. And so he got out of it, which was just sucking him back and forth and spinning the boat. And nobody luckily fell out, and people were hanging on like crazy. And when I hit him, I looked at one of his passengers, and he was bleeding from a head wound all the way down his face onto his life jacket. And I was going, oh, fuck, man. This is just another thing to add on to what we're not even out of the rapid. We're only midway through it, and we've got so much to go through. And here's this guy bleeding like crazy. So finally we got down through Ladle. Everybody made it through there, but nobody could stop. So we ended up... to get to Ladle, you had to go through S-turn and double drop and all that stuff. And that was so full of water. None of those rapids showed, why is this double drop? You know, everything was so full. There was no, like, big holes or anything. It was just fast, big standing waves. And so we got down to the bottom of Ladle, and where everybody's pretty strung out. And we were finding out that people were trying to, and we have not self-bailing boats, so all the boats were full of water all the way to the gunwales. I mean, that was, we were underwater. I mean, I can remember getting stuck in a rapid after Ladle somewhere, and it was a turn from left to right, and the hole was so strong that it slammed me at the bottom and broke my 2x6, 2x8, wooden frame, snapped the frame, and put me down into the water. The boat was full of water. The river was going over the top of the raft.
Wow.
And my frame now was broken, and the oars, being a part of the frame, were now at tube level. So they weren't like up in the air where you had access. So now I'm down at tube level with the river going through me, over and on all my sides, over the boat, and the frame being broken has put me down into the gear stowage area up in front of where your feet would be. I was all gear right there. And so here I couldn't work the oars because I was so low on the boat, and the boat was getting thrashed in the pour-overs and couldn't be really rowed well anymore. And I had, you know, the people were just like up to their stomachs in water, under the water, the boat's under the water. I finally came, after I got spit out, I worked the boat into an eddy, and it went around and around this eddy, and I could almost get to shore and not quite, and almost get to shore and not quite. And this gets back to when I was talking about on the river and rowing, you had to be really fit because you never knew what you were going to run into. Mm. And here I was so exhausted. It was like, I've got to get this boat to shore. I got to tie it off. And boats were now from our trip were going by me because their lines had broken. And they were probably going through what I had gone through. And people were getting left on shore trying to keep boats on shore. But the boats and the ropes would break. And so the boats were going off.
So these are the bow lines or stern lines, as you mentioned,
stern
these
lines.
Hemp ropes that were made to tie the boat to shore. If you could give someone the end of the rope, they could step onto the shore and they could hold the
rope and
swing the boat into shore. If the boat's full of water, it's going to be a pretty hefty weight, and that boat would break. The rope would break.
Exactly.
Oh.
And you might send somebody off the stern with a line and row as much as you could to keep it close and not have the load, and they could tie it off. They wouldn't hold on to it. They could tie it off,
right,
but then that rope would break.
Yeah.
And so it was like when people finally got it together at the bottom of all this stuff, they go, okay, so where's so-and-so? I don't know, the last I saw him, the line had broken. He was on shore and whatever. Oh, it was a calamity. It was like, God, we're out here again and in terrible conditions. And so for me, with my broken frame and sitting in deep in the water on the bottom of the boat, I'm trying to row this boat into shore, and I'm in this eddy, and I'm going around and around, exhausted. And finally, I go, you know, I've got to actually plant myself on the shore. And so I rammed the boat in as much as I could. I jumped off with my rope, and I jumped off with the rope. And like you're saying, it was so heavy that it wanted to pull me and the boat back out into the river and go down through this whole eddy circle again. And that's what it did. I couldn't hold on to the boat. The boat rope didn't snap, but I was dragged back out into the river, hanging onto the rope, people in my boat, and we're either going to go out in the mainstream, which I hope I didn't, or I'm going to
go around
and around.
Yeah.
Me hanging onto this rope. Oh, God, it was just like, fuck. And the one saving grace of that moment was that I had put the cooking grill on the stern of my boat and tied off with other luggage and stuff like that. And I was able to pull myself up to the stern where that grill was, and put my fingers into the metal rungs on
the grill.
And I was able to lock into it as I'm going into this eddy, being drug out again. And if I had gone and tried to go on to like the slippery sides of the boat or tried something else, I was so tired and winded and exhausted from rowing so much. And now I was swimming, staying with this boat with my this and that and up the grill. So I finally get back onto the boat and start rowing. And now it's like, whatever happens, you've got to get this boat stuck on shore, get rested, get control of what's happening with other boats passing me and going downstream. So I finally I was finally able to get in a position where I could row the boat somewhat, and so I really made a strong physical mental commitment that this is it. I'll go around this eddy one time, and whatever it is, I've got to stop this boat. I can't keep going like this. And so somehow I ended up getting to in a good position and hopped off, you know, plowed through a bunch of boulders or whatever and held on and finally anchored the boat and gave people a chance to get off and get their wind back and give me some rest. And then the boats were coming in and communicating as to what happened, who's where, what's going on. That was a sailway to that point, and we still had gotten through the ladle stuff. And then we went, if you know where Little Niagara Falls is, the water was over the top of Little Niagara Rock. Hmm. That's an idea if you go on the sailway and you go by this big mammoth. You know, it's almost like a volcanic neck sticking out of the river. But it's really, when you see it with the water at the base, and then you look up and you go, wow, the water went over the top of this thing.
Yeah. Scott, let's back up for a minute. You've got a 2x6 wooden frame, which is basically a square or sort of a rectangle of wood.
Yeah.
It's bolted together in the corners, and there's blocks bolted halfway along for your thole pins, for your pins and clips on your oars. Nobody's running open oar locks like those Dorys, those Helfrich guys are. And when you break the wooden frame, typically there's some splintery edges there, some sharp wood that then can cause tear on the boat to the raft, to the rubber of the raft.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not the case with your frame break. The boat didn't get damaged at all. You just broke the frame.
I don't recollect that the when the frame broke, it went all the way down as far as it could go. And I, with that comment, you're probably correct in that. But I think, and I remember now, the boat was full of water, and that broken frame could only go so far because I had people's gear in black bags under the seat part.
Sure.
And the frame would break, and I think it was stopped because of that.
Okay.
And all those bags, they were tied up, but they all floated. So they all, that's another problem, is they floated up above my oars. Not only was I sunk, but the bags came up and wouldn't let me row because they were all in the way floating around. They were tied up, but they were floating around. That was another nightmare. You're bringing up all these nightmares at the moment. But after all that, we kind of regrouped when we finally got together. And I think we had made it through all of the big stuff, and we were finally out into more normal flow, and the water was high enough that rocks were covered, and we were just screaming down the rivers all. But seeing Little Niagara the following year and then private trips and seeing that, God, the river was over the top of this thing.
Cheers.
And it was very interesting when we got to that and saw the water over it, the boils, whirlpools, and the aeration below Little Niagara Rock and the pour over, there was a whole section there of boiling, surging water from all of the fall it had to take, and the big rock and filling in the water behind that rock. It was some feeling in a boat that I had never ever felt. It was unbelievable that the boat was sinking in aeration from the water below the Little Niagara Rock.
Wow.
You're sunk because of the aeration.
Huh.
And that was like we were all finally all together kind of in this mammoth, like whirlpool kind of bubbling, foamy situation. And we were all just like looking at each other. And if our eyes weren't big enough, it was like, wow, we've never been into anything like this. And it finally spit us out eventually at the bottom of all this. But we were there just underwater with bubbles. And you couldn't get any purchase with your oars because it was all aerated. So that was another interesting thing.
Hmm.
So, but from there, we went on down and pulled over and regrouped and
going that fast. It's time for another layover.
Yeah, really, really, God. So that's that particular Salway trip. So
okay. You know what? We've been yik-yakking for over an hour here. How about we put a comma in this oral history series?
Sure.
And come back at it again another day. I'm all tuckered out from all this high water river running here. You got me all tired.
You got the story from me reliving it. You know, as I lay here, there's things that triggered this thing, and they go, oh, yeah, that's what happened right there. That's what happened there. I mean, you're putting me through living it again, really.
Well, I hope you're enjoying it, because you know, now on a nice sunny day, it's a little more easy to think about, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, the other thing, the only thing, are we off?
No, we're still going.
Okay, I'm just going to say, and I mentioned this before on the Middle Fork, anytime it was sunny and you had really bad conditions on the river, it was like, well, at least it's sunny. That's always what I would say. I go, God, at least it's warm and sunny. Even if there was snow on the ground and there were ice cold water, I'm going, wow, it's happy day because it's sunny. What a beautiful place. And that's how the Selway was on that horrific day of breaking everything and everything, people being spread out all over the place. It was a warm, sunny day, still with snow behind the rock from the trees, but it was a sunny day and no wind. So anyway, that was a blessing.
Lovely. Yeah. Yeah. Take what you can get.
Oh God. Yes. There is happiness somewhere.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, with that, let's conclude part two of Grand Canyon Oral History with Scott Emsland. Today is Monday, March 6th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.